Welcome to the second season of the Smarter Apple Spraying podcast series. I'm your host, Mark Gleason, a plant pathologist at Iowa State University. I'm also the leader of a USDA-funded research and outreach project that's looking for more efficient and lower-cost ways to protect apples against diseases and insect pests. The project includes scientists, students, and growers in Iowa and Ohio. Okay, well, welcome to the Smarter Spraying for Apples podcast. I'm your host, Mark Gleason, and we have two special guests today on this episode. Dr. Suzanne Slack, who is an assistant professor of horticulture at Iowa State University, and Dr. George Sundin, who's a professor of plant pathology at Michigan State University. And the subject today is fire blight and the Mary blight warning system. So what I'm going to do, ask of you two, is that you'll, the questions essentially be toss-up questions, so you can decide who's going to answer them, or both, it doesn't matter, or whether you want to do a Greek chorus, it's okay. But first of all, the individual question, could you let the listeners know professionally how you, what's been your journey to where you are? So Suzanne?
So hi, I'm Suzanne Slack. So my journey to where I am today, I started off doing my undergrad at Penn State, and I worked in the research orchards there. And while I was there, we had a bunch of fire blight outbreaks, and I thought someone should really do something about this. So I was told that Dr. Sundin is doing something about this. So I reached out to him and he hired me, and I did my master's with him. I then went and worked for Virginia Cooperative Extension for 2 years, then came back to Michigan with Dr. Sundin to do a PhD. I defended and graduated in late 2020. Then I did a postdoc for a year with Dr. Sarah Villani on grapes. And I've been faculty at Iowa State University for about 3 months now in horticulture for fruit crops.
We're glad you're here, Suzanne. Thank you. George?
Okay, boy, that's be a long journey for me, but I'll just say that I've always been interested in bacteria and fruit trees along the way. And so I got my undergrad at Penn State as well as Suzanne, and I got my start at Michigan State with Al Jones, who is our tree fruit pathologist here. And I worked on bacterial canker, Pseudomonas syringae disease of cherry. And that really got me going into further work with plant pathogenic bacteria. Got my PhD at Oklahoma State working with Pseudomonas syringae. I started a faculty position at Texas A&M University, but it was very hot down there and not a lot of bacterial diseases. So when Dr. Jones retired, they recruited me to come back here to Michigan State. I've been here since 2002, predominantly working on fire blight, but all other tree fruit diseases of apple, cherry, and peach.
Great. Thanks, George. Thanks, both of you. Now, if we start to kind of seg into the biology here, this is, you know, this podcast is really aimed at growers. So how can a grower be sure that they're looking at fire blight symptoms? Is it a dead bang that you always know when you see a symptom, or are there any lookalikes?
So for blossom blight, the best way to tell if the best lookalike or the most common lookalike that I've seen is frost damage can mimic fire blight sometimes, but looking for that yellowish or orange discolored tissue or seeing ooze is a good way to differentiate between blossom blight and damage to flowers from either phytotoxicity of chemicals or from frost damage. For shoot blight, it can get a little trickier. There's a disease called nectaria canker, which can mimic the flagging that we see for shoot blight infection with fire blight. Cold damage appearing later in the season can also appear if there's been damage to the cambium. It can have some of that wilting appearance. But for shoot blight, typically what we see is the shoot kind of deteriorates from the top down. And for frost damage or for the fungal canker disease, it'll kind of start from the bottom up. And of course, there'll be ooze with fire blight. So ooze is sticky droplets that come out of the infected plant tissue, and they're brightly colored. They're hard to miss. So that's the telltale signs of fire blight. Was there anything else you could think of, George?
Well, just when you see that ooze in your orchard, never touch it. Suzanne worked on ooze for a long time, and it's very concentrated droplets of fire blight pathogen cells. And so that's the natural mechanism for spreading, and we can spread that as people as well. So you never want to touch that, because the bacteria can get on you and then easily spread.
And just a follow-up question for both of you. If you see the symptoms that Suzanne was describing, but you don't see ooze, does that mean it's not fire blight?
No, I mean, you don't always get ooze, or sometimes, and ooze droplets come out and then they dry up and they can fall off. So they can be hard to see. But yeah, so fire blight's generally a wilt symptom, but as Suzanne said, it's the tips are dying from the top down. That's kind of the best way to notice it. And you can see if your flower clusters are dying. One thing about the flower clusters when they get blossom blight is they hang on, they never drop off the tree. And so you can see that later in June, for example, and you'll know you've got fire blight there.
Okay, I'll just share a little anecdotes from my experience in Iowa, and that I've been in orchards, commercial orchards, where we see a lot of fire blight, but we don't see much blossom blight at all. We don't see any evidence, you know, like you talked about, George, where they're hanging on, the blossoms are hanging on, and they're, but oftentimes it's several weeks after the bloom period, after the last blossoms have fallen, that suddenly we get this big outbreak on susceptible varieties. So, do you think it's true that you can get shoot blight without blossom blight?
Oh, you certainly can. So if the fire blight bacteria overwinters in the tree in cankers, and these cankers activate in the spring as temperatures warm and the trees start getting active. But sometimes if temperatures are cold at bloom time, you may not get infection, or sometimes the bacteria emerging from cankers emerge later than bloom. And so that's how you can get, and so that emerging bacteria from cankers later than bloom can still, those cells can still infect shoots and cause shoot blight. So that's how you can get shoot blight outbreaks without blossom blight.
I've stood face to face with growers in orchards and tried to explain exactly that to them, that, oh, you know, I didn't have any blossom blight, but boom, I've got this. So what's happening with shoot blight? Is that, how does the bacteria get in? I mean, they're on the outside, right? So how do they get in if they don't go through blossoms? How do they get into those shoots later after the bloom period?
Well, at those shoot tips, there's microscopic wounds that we can't see, and the bacteria go through those wounds. And the problem with shoot blight is it doesn't take very many cells. There's been research over the years, only like 1,000 cells are required to cause a shoot infection. And so that's our big problem. When we're talking about an ooze droplet, that can contain a billion cells. So there's enough cells in an ooze droplet to infect all the shoots in the orchard, really. That's the problem we face trying to deal with that aspect of the disease.
So pretty hard to manage shoot blight, isn't it? I mean, if you're just talking about these wounds that occur on those shoot tips, I mean, there's not really a way to manage that, is there?
We can't manage the wounds, but we can manage shoot blight. I'll let Suzanne talk about prohexidione calcium, which is a really excellent tool for shoot blight management.
Great. That'd be great, Suzanne, please.
Yeah, sure. So prohexidione calcium, there's a couple of commercial formulations of it, but one, especially in larger trees, there's been a lot of research to prove that it pretty much shuts down the spread of the bacteria. And some of the research that I've done has been looking at lower rates on smaller trees. So starting to think about management for our dwarf trees and not our traditional 111 rootstock trees. And these lower rates are still able to shut down. Whenever I mean shut down, I mean the bacteria just doesn't seem to migrate further down the shoots. So we've done some work with looking at the bacterial populations and looking at just disease severity and the spread of disease down a shoot. And we're able to pretty much keep it from moving into the rest of the tree by using some of these rates and spray programs. So I think Dr. Senden's continuing some of this work and doing a little bit more specifications with it currently in his lab.
And the prohexidione calcium, either Apogee or Kudos, it does shut down a lot of infection. It does prevent a lot of infection. And if infection does occur, as Suzanne said, it slows the migration. So it gives you time to prune out an infected shoot before the bacteria spreads to the central leader of the tree. So it's a really excellent tool for management. And the work we've done years ago now, we found that using this material causes the plant cells, the cell walls to get wider, to become wider. And so we think it's a physical barrier to infection. And so it's a really nice material for fire blight control.
Okay. Let me just push on that, further on that. So the Apogee or Kudos, they're thickening the cell walls of the apple tree. That makes them harder to attack. Did they have any effect on like cessation of the extension of the shoot? Do they have a growth regulator effect on the tree as well?
I can answer that. So the answer is yes. So some of the research that we've been doing has been to try to find a middle ground where the shoots aren't as impacted on their growth, but the cells are thick enough that the bacteria can't successfully get through those thickening cells. So that's what we've been doing for the past maybe 4 or 5 years now, is testing those rates. And we haven't just been testing them in Michigan. We have some collaborators in the East Coast testing these rates too. And it seems to be working without causing too much detriment to the growth. Because I know, especially with those young trees, telling someone that they need to stunt their young trees is just not economically feasible.
Even with, if I understand you right, Suzanne, then it's a different ball game if you're talking to somebody with a fully grown in orchard block compared to somebody with young trees that are still filling that space. Is that the recommendations would be different then?
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you. That's more actually than that extends my knowledge about Apogee. Is there a worry that if you put on too much Apogee, you could reduce future bearing, or is that not an issue?
I mean, in general, we use Apogee for shoot blight control, say in the Midwest in the month of later in May through June. And so after that, the tree will grow out of that treatment, say in July and August. So you will get, generally we'll get enough growth to overcome any potential effects on next year's fruit set and things like that.
I see. That clarifies that. Thanks, George. Okay, so what else do we have in the bag of tricks then against fire blight? Some of these will be familiar to growers. Some of them haven't used Apogee or Kudos, but they've used some of the other things. Could you kind of go through some of those other weapons?
So I think the main weapon that we have is antibiotic sprays during bloom. So right now on the registered market, we have streptomycin, we have tetracycline, and we have a newer one, which is casugamycin or casumin. And that one's been around for 8 years, I think now.
Yeah, about that.
Mm-hmm. About 8 years. So if you don't, and then there's also different copper formulations that can also be used, as well as many different biological control agents that are registered for suppression of fire blight during bloom.
If I just can follow up on something you just said there, what's been the experience with the biological controls on fire blight, let's say in Michigan or elsewhere? Have they attracted a kind of a following among growers?
I mean, people are using biologicals. The issue of comparing biologicals to antibiotics is always not a great comparison, because with something like streptomycin or casumin, in tests we do, we can expect 90 to 100% control, even under very high pressure like we test. Whereas the biologicals typically will give us 50% control, or 1 year they might give us 75% control, and the next year might be 25%. So the problem that we have with the biologicals is they're fairly variable, but there are some timings or conditions where disease pressure, say, is low to moderate, when a biological would be expected to work quite well Whereas when disease pressure is higher, we wouldn't expect them to work as well. And that will come when we discuss the Mary Blight model. We can talk about the outputs the model gives us that might direct us to use a biological instead of an antibiotic.
Okay. Following up, you had mentioned, George, that control with some of these antibiotic products can be really high. But there's been some Achilles heels there in terms of antibiotic resistance, and you've been in the forefront of that, both of you. Could you kind of lay out the landscape there for growers about where we stand with resistance to these antibiotic products?
Sure. The one antibiotic, streptomycin. So that's been used in apple orchards since the 50s or 60s. It's been used for a long time. And in Michigan, for example, we used to use that even to control shoot blight. So growers would spray that all through the summer as well. And what happened with that is that led to the development of streptomycin resistance in the fire blight pathogen, where if the pathogen is resistant, you could spray streptomycin and get absolutely no control. It'd be like spraying water on the trees. And so that's a big problem. And streptomycin resistance is fairly widespread in Michigan, but it's of limited occurrence in other regions out east. There's some occurrence in New York State, but say in New England and other places, they have not detected resistance. But in those orchards, in those areas, growers haven't overused streptomycin like we did for a period of time in Michigan. And I think that's something Suzanne can talk to, and that's really important in terms of resistance management.
Yeah, and so that kind of brings us towards the Mary Blight situation a bit, doesn't it? Did you want to comment on how the antibiotic resistance risk thing fits into the use of a warning system like Mary Blight?
Sure. So for those not familiar, Mary Blight is a warning system for fire blight incidents during bloom that is widely used on the East Coast. And what Mary Blight does is it takes numerous factors into consideration and gives a number that is the EIP, which is the epiphytic potential. So, sorry, some of the times the words get jumbled in my head. And based on this number, it'll let us know if an infection is calculated to be imminent. So doing this, using this warning system, it'll tell you if the conditions in the orchard are right for an infection event to occur. So using that along with antibiotics, you can actually reduce the number of sprays that you apply in your orchard. If the conditions just aren't favorable, you might be able to skip a spray. So instead of doing maybe 5 sprays, you could bring it down to 3, for instance.
And did I hear you right, to Suzanne, or I can't remember, you mentioned that these sprays that Mary Blight is helping timing with are primarily aimed at the bloom period, right?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so a grower could actually put on as many as 5, depending on the variety and the risk and so forth.
Hopefully not.
Yeah, that's relatively high. We like to keep it in the 3 to 4 range. And so this EIP number, that can be really high. That can be 200, 300, 400 if it's like potential for severe outbreaks, but it can also be lower. Say if the number is 40, then there's a small risk there, but the risk is not high. And so what we suggest is if that number is say between 40 and 70, those are the timings when we can use biological controls or other materials. We don't have to use the antibiotics because the risk is lower. But to me, if that number is 70 to 100 or higher, that's the timings for streptomycin or casumin.
So it's that gray zone of low risk but not no risk that some right. of these other products can fit into. I see. If you're chronologically going through the bloom period and the period just up to bloom, how would one look at that Mary Blight output what factors, what weather factors are going in here? You know, you mentioned EIP, Suzanne, but what about the weather drivers? What are they?
All right. So for Mary Blight, to tell you the way it works, I'll just go over the four main conditions that are required for it to tell you if an infection is imminent. So the first one is there needs to be flowers, open flowers that are relatively intact, which makes sense. Accumulation of at least 198 degree hours over 65 Fahrenheit within the last 80 days. A wedding event, so that's any wedding event, so a dew or any amount of rain over like 0.01 inches or a rain the previous day. Then it also requires an average daily temperature above 60 degrees Fahrenheit.
Okay, and those are the kind of the precursors to set up the conditions that would allow an infection to occur.
According to Mary Blight, yes.
Yeah, of course, according to Mary Blight, and that's where I wanted to go, because I recall you're describing your research and some of your published research with George about kind of taking another look at Mary Blight and whether everything in that model, which the model is now, what, 30 years old, more than that? If I remember correctly, your conclusion was that Mary Blight needed to change just a little bit. Could you kind of describe what that was?
Yeah, so some of the research that we've been doing over the past 5 or so years has been following the bacterial populations on the stigmas through different weather conditions over the years. And what we found was substantial growth occurring of the bacteria on flowers in an orchard with the air temperature being quite lower than 60 degrees Fahrenheit, which would potentially set you up for an infection event. So if your temperature never reached that 60 degrees minimum, your EIP is going to be a lot lower and Mary Blight won't tell you that there's an infection event imminent. So you still could have a large amount of bacteria. And if there was a weather, a rain event, that bacteria could get pushed down into the flower and cause infection.
So if I understood you right, Suzanne, you might call it the problem period or the area that you were working on is that period when the temperatures are low enough that they're not really optimal for this bacterium, Erwinia mellifera. But if I'm correct from what you said, the bacteria just don't disappear or plummet when that temperature is below the optimum. They just sort of hang out there and may even multiply.
Yes.
So looking at the Mary Blight system as it's applied, not only in the East, but in the Midwest, is it time to change the way the temperature is, time to change the way temperature is used to calculate risk?
So I'm not sure if we're there yet to say that temperature needs to be changed, but another factor that we are trying to incorporate into the model right now is actually wind speed. Mm. So we found a significant correlation between wind speed and the amount of bacteria that was growing. And I think that's kind of where our research is headed for the next step, is to figure out how to incorporate that factor in with this, as well as temperature.
Okay, well, that's really interesting. I hadn't heard you talk about that before. Okay, I'm a bacterium. I'm on the surface of a shoot. How does wind speed affect my chances of getting into the shoot?
So if the wind is higher, there's more desiccation occurring, and that is our current hypothesis. So if the wind is lower, and it's very still, and if the temperature is dropping, the bacteria doesn't seem to be as affected as if there's higher wind with a lower temperature.
So go ahead, George.
Yeah, sorry, Mark. This also comes into play significantly during the night, during the overnight hours. If winds are calm overnight, we get dew formation. And what Suzanne found, she did several overnight studies and found that the bacteria actually multiply better at overnight during the evening between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. At least she said she was out there at 10 p.m. and 2 a.m.
Nobody was out there.
But I believe her. And so what we conjectured was that, yeah, when wind speeds were lower at night, that would promote dew formation, and that moisture then on the stigma surface then promotes cell division, growth of the bacteria. Because originally, when she told me that the stats supported that decreasing wind speeds affected growth, I was confused myself until we figured out that going out overnight, and this is when the growth was actually occurring.
All right, I don't want to get too far in the weeds here, but you got me interested here. So wind speeds are low. Of course, that's a precursor for dew formation at night, right? You have calm and the sky is clear. Could the effect of lower wind speed on the increased risk of fire blight invasion be related to, let's say, relative humidity or the presence of dew, with wind speed just sort of being a surrogate for those factors? I mean, you keep mentioning dew formation, and am I making sense?
It all could be, but you do the dew. What was the number, Suzanne, for the wind has to be slower than two meters?
I think it was 1.7.
You don't get dew formation if the wind speed is higher than 1.7, is it meters per second? I don't remember what the units are. So there does have to be some relative calmness of the winds. We live in a very humid region of the country in the Midwest. There is evidence out in the far west where they grow apples in the deserts of Washington that winds will dry out the flowers and that decreases growth of the bacteria. But we don't, you know, we typically will not see those kinds of conditions in our region of the country.
You're listening to the Smarter Apple Spraying podcast series. I'm your host, Mark Gleason. Our three-year project is searching for more profitable and less wasteful ways to control diseases and pests on apples. Now, back to our interview. Paul Steiner, kind of the original guru behind Miri Blight, he used to talk about high wind being a factor if you had ooze formation, that the ooze droplets or strands could be blown through the orchard. But this is the opposite side of things, isn't it? This is the low wind being associated with a higher risk of, I don't know whether right. Paul really had evidence for that, but that's what he used to say. And I don't know if you guys have seen it, but occasionally I've seen stripes through an orchard where you can see like a strip in a windward direction where an apparent source was seemed to have been blown through the orchard in the downwind direction. Does that happen?
This is two different modes thinking about wind. So right, when we think about spread of fire blight among trees or between trees, wind and rain are definitely driving that. And in some of our orchards where we're next to dirt roads, you can see in the outside rows of the orchard where wind has blown sand from the dirt roads and injured the trees, and fire blight spreads easily among those. So that's spreading among trees. That's wind, where wind speeds are important, higher winds, more spread. But we're talking right now about growth on flowers, and that is needed before infection can occur. And so in that sense, the growth is conditioned by low wind speeds that promote dew. So it's kind of two different stories. And then if you had blossom blight infection and ooze, then it would be higher winds and rain that could spread that to more trees.
I see. Yeah, thanks. I've never understood it, but that clarity before. It's really helpful and I'm sure for growers as well. We have these, you know, there's always a question when you're measuring weather information, whether it's wind speed or, you know, relative humidity or leaf wetness duration or temperature, how do you get that information, right? And if I understand correctly, fire blight, you really need that information every hour. You need it frequently, right? That not, you can't just do a daily average. That's not, you know, fire blight moves too quick. So could you comment, either both of you, about how these weather services like EnviroWeather and NIWA, that will send you data, how they kind of fit into the fire blight management picture through Miri Blight?
I can talk more about EnviroWeather than NIWA, unfortunately, is at this point in time, just since that's what we use in Michigan, and that's what my most of my experience has been about. So the stations relay the information to EnviroWeather, and the best thing to do is if you are growing apples or any fruit really, or specialty crop, really getting a weather station close to your orchard or close to your land is really important, because if there's not a weather station nearby, it's going to be using the closest weather station to you. And I think if you're within like 5 kilometers from the weather station, that's probably good. But if it's more than that, then you should consider maybe investing into one and getting hooked up into that system. But using the hourly weather is the best way to go about it. Mary Blight actually does use an average daily temperature as its calculation. The system they have out west uses a rolling hourly average, which is Cougar Blight. But I don't think that we, at least for EnviroWeather, last time I checked, that wasn't an option. And we're not, George mentioned previous, there's a lot of different weather differences with out west in the deserts where they grow apples out there versus here. So I wouldn't recommend switching to that for our East Coast growers.
Here's just a technical question, Suzanne. Okay, so let's say Mary Blight, as you pointed out, uses the average daily temperature. I assume that that is not just a high low divided by two. It's probably a summation of every hour over that day. Would that be right? Or are they just using the daily high and the daily low and dividing by two? Or are they making us an average of all those hours?
As far as I know, they're using an average of all the hours. It's not just the high low divided by two.
Yeah, that'd be my guess too. But honestly, I know very little about EnviroWeather and not much more about NIWA. Here in Iowa, we are just kind of in the infancy of using these networks, these regional weather networks. NIWA, a few growers have been working or experimenting with NIWA as we get more stations here in Iowa. But it's, like I say, very much, we have a lot to learn from places like Michigan. What kind of savings on the average? I know it's not the same every year, but on the average, if a grower uses Mary Blight and they've been just kind of using a protective sort of schedule before that in previous years, what could they expect to save on an average if they're spraying a susceptible variety, like a one spray a year, two spray a year? I'm talking average now.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible to save sprays, but I think the better finding from using the weather data and predictive models is your sprays are better timed. And so if the timing of your application is better, is more close to the actual infection period for apple scab or fire blight, you're going to get better disease management in the end. So I think I mean, saving sprays sometimes works well, but sometimes you could be burned by it too if you don't get back into the orchard when you have to. I try to think of it more as we're going to time our applications better and we're going to get better disease management overall from that.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. And as a long-term strategy, the payoff is, as you said, going to be greater because you're using stewardship on your product so that you have them, right, in the future. Right.
And I think the more that growers use these models, the better you're going to understand how the disease is attacking your crops. And that's also going to help you in the long run, you know, in terms of management.
Yeah, and as you both pointed out, you know, there's a lot of ins and outs to fire blight, right? There's a lot of it's been studied intensively, but it's a famously elusive disease. And so the greater command a grower feels about managing the risk, probably the more successful he or she will be. Yeah, so that totally makes sense to me. Now, suppose you're a grower who's maybe doesn't want to sign up, maybe financially or for some other reason, doesn't want to sign up to EnviroWeather and wants to go it alone with Mary Blight. Can they do that all right? Can they just set up their own weather station and be kind of a commando Mary Blight for their own orchard?
Yes, you can do that. Although I would recommend getting hooked up to the NIWA system because you get a lot more benefits doing
NIWA,
that.
NIWA or EnviroWeather. What's an advantage? I mean, to belonging to the network like this compared to, let's say, going it alone, if you're in the middle of a growing season, the middle of bloom, and, you know, you're worried and thinking about when to put on a spray against fire blight. Are there ways in which belonging to a network can actually help you in that situation?
Yes. So first off, you'll have, some tech support from the system. So if there's a problem, they'll be able to help you figure it out a little better. The second is, it's not just, the stations aren't just for diseases. There's a lot of different models available. So whether that's trying to figure out when to best thin your apples, looking at carbohydrate accumulations, how fast your pollen tube formation is occurring too, are all available through these systems. So it's not just for diseases. So you're getting more bang for your buck, really, because you're getting all these different systems.
It's not just buying a book, it's buying a library.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, well, that's impressive. And that, as he pointed out, the tech support as well. Any other comments either of you would like to make about where you see Mary Blight going, or how growers in your experience have commented on their experience with Mary Blight?
From what I've heard in my experience is we're going to, in the next couple of years, try to revamp it a bit and see if we can, especially with the information that we've gotten with both wind and some of these lower temperatures, as well as kind of diving into these situations that we're seeing more and more during bloom, which is we'll have a temperature of like 60 and then the temperature is going to plummet and then come back up. So we're seeing a lot more variability with our weather during bloom in the past couple of years. So figuring out how we can better utilize the systems with that huge variation that we can see during some springs.
And growers just like it because it just makes things, you know, once they understand it, it makes things easy for them. And then, you know, we have these number ranges where they're thinking about different kinds of materials to use. And I think it just helps your decision-making process, both in terms of timing and what you're going to use. And that ultimately helps you a lot in the long run.
Maybe a final question. How do you, when you talk to growers, George or Suzanne, about variety selection in, you know, the world that also includes fire blight, is this something that you feel growers are using as part of their calculation when they're deciding varieties to plant? That is fire blight risk of the variety?
I think the big problem we have is the varieties that are commercially the best, for the most part, are highly susceptible to fire blight. The only one that is not as susceptible is Honeycrisp, luckily for us. But Gala, Fuji, new varieties we might grow like Evercrisp, these are all highly susceptible to fire blight and we can't do anything about it. So we do talk somewhat about variety choice, but if you to really get the best returns, you've got to grow Galas or whatever. And so we work more on how best to manage these diseases until, I mean, one of the research arms of this, I'm leading a US-wide fire blight grant from USDA. And one of the arms of that is to try to breed fire blight resistance into commercially, you know, varieties that will be commercially popular. And so that's coming down the road. That's a long-term, you know, 10 years plus goal. But hopefully at some point we can have varieties that the consumer wants to eat that are fire blight resistant. But until then, our best bet is just managing. And I think we have tools and we have strategies to effectively manage blight, even in something like Gala that can blow out of control. But we can do it.
Great. Well, thanks to both of you. I really appreciate your time. This has been, I think, fascinating, and certainly to me, and I know to growers as well. So thanks, y'all.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
See you later. Bye now. Thanks for listening to this episode of the second season of the Smarter Apple Spraying podcast series. You can find more episodes in this series at our website. The link is www.smartapplespray.plantpath.iastate.edu. The host for the series is Mark Gleason. Jose Gonzalez is the editor. The Smarter Apple Spraying podcast series is funded by a grant from USDA's Crop Protection and Pest Management Initiative.
For more information about the two-state project, contact either Mark Gleason at mgleason@iastate.edu in Iowa or Melanie Lewis Ivy, ivy.14@osu.edu in Ohio.